Breadbox Media programming is brought to you by introducing the redesigned CatholicSingles.com, featuring new ways that put the spotlight on the person and their faith, not just a profile picture. For the past 20 years, faithful Catholics have used CatholicSingles.com, and the reimagined CatholicSingles.com website is ready to help single Catholics take the next step in sharing meaningful relationships with other faithful Catholics. Remember, CatholicSingles.com for faith, fellowship, and love. What are you doing this Lent? The St. Paul Center is streaming their newest video Bible study for free starting Ash Wednesday. Based on Scott Hahn's renowned covenantal theology, this is a study no one should miss. Invite your friends, Catholic or not. Don't miss your chance to see this premium study for free. Go to stpaulcenter.com to sign up today.
Welcome to Beneath the Surface. Good evening, everybody. Glad you could be here tonight. Paul Morano here with one of my special guests. I'll introduce him in a second. Here at WCAP Radio, another edition of Beneath the Surface until 11 p.m. Welcoming your phone calls if you would like to join our conversation and delve beneath the surface with us on a topic hopefully interesting to you. Certainly relating to the human condition. We are live streamed also through the internet. And tonight's topic that we're going to delve beneath the surface on is the transcendence and immanence of God. The transcendence and immanence of God. What does that mean? Well, I'm glad I asked. Well, let me put it this way. How can God be totally other and intimately present without contradiction? Deists see him as totally other. Pantheists as totally present. We'll talk about what those things mean. However, Christians understand God to be both simultaneously transcendent and immanent. So how can that be? Well, to uncover some of this mystery is right across from me. There he is, the man, the myth, the legend, Mr. Bob LeBlanc.
I'm a myth?
You are.
Wow.
Yes.
Am I like a unicorn or something like that?
You are, yes. See, you're only a voice, you're a bodiless voice. People think there's actually a body here in the studio, but they don't really understand.
Oh, so I'm a spirit.
And the spirits don't have physical voices.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Okay.
So you're just a physical voice.
A physical voice.
Yes.
With no material existence.
No, none whatsoever.
Oh, gee.
Yeah. So that's why you're a myth, and you're a mystery, and you're Mr. Bob LeBlanc, not to be confused with the Bob LeBlanc that at least used to work here at WCAP. I'm not sure if he still does.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I don't.
You probably should check up on that just to make sure before you say something like that again, you know?
Yeah, he might be on the outs with the station as far as I know. I have no idea.
Well, you know, wouldn't you know it, they'll probably have a commercial for him during the show, you know?
Could be. But anyway, if they do, that is not you. You
That's
are not,
not me.
You're not a lawyer. You are a philosopher and a historian, but you do not practice law.
No, that would be probably illegal for me to practice law.
Yes, if you were to try, yes. 978-454-4980 is our phone number. The BTS hotline, again, is 978-454-4980. Beneath the Surface, where faith and reason meet, every Monday night between 10 and 11, bringing a little sanity into our age of insanity, a little life into our culture of death. Okay, Mr. Bob.
Yes, Paul.
Before we get into our topic, today is your birthday.
Oh, you had to tell everybody in the world that.
Yes, because everybody in the world is listening live.
That's right.
Happy birthday.
Yeah,
thank you.
From our producer, Cindy, happy birthday. And happy birthday on behalf of our entire million-man BTS audience.
Wow.
Yes.
Million Man Audience.
They're all singing. As a matter of fact, Million Man Audience, if you want to make yourself heard and tell Bob, our regular BTS guest, happy birthday, feel free to call in right now, 978-454-4980. You don't have to say who you are. Just say happy birthday. 978-454-4980. Okay. As they're clamoring for their telephones to do that, also today, which is February 11th, is the feast day, according to the Catholic calendar, the feast day of Our Lady of Lourdes.
Yes.
Want to say a little something about that and how that relates to you and your birthday?
Well, yes. Well, there's a actually quite an involved story here. So,
well, unfortunately, we only have an hour. We've got a big topic tonight.
Well, of course, I was born on Our Lady of Lourdes, the anniversary of the apparition in France.
Yeah.
And the seer was this petite little young peasant girl in France, in southern France.
Her name was Bernadette.
Her name was Bernadette.
Subaru. Bernadette Subaru.
And so she saw a vision of Mary. Nobody else saw it. She was with some friends the first time, and they were going, "What are you doing?" You know. And she saw the Blessed Virgin Mary there in a grotto. And
a grotto was like a rock formation, which is hollow.
Right.
And she was in front of that formation.
Yeah, it was next to a river. Yeah.
Okay.
And you know, there were several apparitions and. Frankly, church authorities and civil authorities thought that maybe she was a little bit insane or crazy or something like that.
Right.
They didn't really believe her at first, but eventually they did, and they saw her digging up a hole, which eventually became the waters of Lourdes that people are healed by.
Mm.
And so, you know, and you know, people started believing. Her story. And the other thing was is that a few years before, Pope Pius IX declared the dogma of Mary's Immaculate Conception.
Yeah.
And she was not very well catechized, so...
The little girl.
Yeah, Bernadette. And... She was asked, you know, to find out what the lady's name was that she was seeing. She never claimed it to be the Blessed Virgin Mary.
Right. She just said, a lady keeps appearing to me.
Right.
Right.
Okay. And she repeated the words, and she didn't understand the words. She just repeated the words, and she told the priest, the pastor of that village, you know, that the lady said, "I am the Immaculate Conception." Which is actually kind of a strange way to put it. But eventually they believed what she was saying. She couldn't have known that. She was very innocent and humble.
Right.
And
just to fill in a little bit for non-Catholics, Pope Pius XI had... Pope Pius IX defined in the 1800s that a belief that the church had believed since the beginning, but he just simply underscored and defined it as saying that the mother of Jesus, Mary the Theotokos, was conceived without the stain of original sin, which means that God, in his ultimate eternal plan, chose to create his mother without inheriting the original sin that everyone else inherited, because, of course, the perfect God could not take flesh from sinful flesh. It's very fitting. So the teaching was that she was immaculately conceived without original sin. And like you said, Saint Bernadette comes back to the authorities and says, "The lady told me that she was the Immaculate Conception," which is interesting.
Right.
And of course, Bernadette couldn't have made that up, and she never was taught it before,
right,
as far as we know.
As far as we know, well, she was 14 years old, and she had not received her first communion. She was actually being held back in her catechism classes, what we would call CCD these days. She was being held back. She was the oldest girl in her class, because she kept on missing classes because she was sickly, and she wasn't catching on with this stuff very well. But anyways,
all right.
That's the beginnings of St. Bernadette there, anyways.
Okay, so we go from that to our topic of this evening, and that is the transcendence and immanence of God, which means that God transcends his creation. He's outside of the space, the space-time matter continuum, but he is also immanent in it. He is closer to us than we are to ourselves. So how do you do both of these things at the same time? Bob, where do you want to start with this?
Well, actually, I think I want to start with Mary.
Okay, perfect. Perfect.
Because, well, let's do a little bit of history here.
All right, my historian.
Kind of a theological history.
Let's do it.
And it's something that you know about. You probably know it better than I do. We're talking about God's approach to man after the fall.
Okay.
So what we have here is we have Adam and Eve. They're walking in the garden, and they haven't sinned yet. And there's this relationship between God and Adam and Eve.
Yep.
And then they sin, and they fall from that connection with God.
Yeah. From grace. Yeah.
From grace. And then various things, men continue to sin, and they keep on losing sight of God.
Yeah.
And then you have this...
That's what sin does. Sin blinds the heart and
right.
the mind. Okay.
So you have that, and then you start losing the sense. And now we're getting into history more from the secular realm here. We have mankind not really understanding anything about God. There are... gods there, and
or at least they recognize gods with a small g.
Gods with a small g, and these are actually kind of immanent gods. If you know what I'm saying here, they're gods that seem to be just like men but more powerful kind of thing.
Yeah. So they're finite, sort of human like supermen, if
right.
you will.
So
and this took the place of the understanding of the one true God,
right.
because they lost sight of that, so their religious sense, and because human nature maintained its religious sense,
right.
but in losing sight of the one true, eternal, infinite God, mankind began to attribute forces of nature to individual gods with a small g, yes?
Right,
okay.
right, exactly.
Okay.
And so, but all these gods are immanent, what we would call yeah. close. They're close to men and women, and so you have God going, well, I've got to correct this somehow, and he's what he's doing is he's trying through Abraham, and he's trying through Isaac and Israel. He's trying to teach them about who he is, who God is. He's trying to reveal himself. And the first thing that he's trying to do is he's trying to say, look, there's one God, and he's trying to say that this God is really transcendent. He's trying to teach the Israelite people about his transcendence.
Yeah, it's interesting how, what was I going to say? That's... one of the main themes, and you're getting to it, you're getting at this right now, one of the main themes of the Old Testament, especially the first half before the prophets, is God trying to wean off this new people, beginning with Abraham, the people of Israel, trying to wean them off of polytheism.
Right.
And it's quite a task, because they were really conditioned, like the rest of the world around them, to polytheism, that there were many so-called gods.
And they kept on falling into it. I mean,
yeah.
all of Israelite or Jewish history in the Old Testament is about the God saying, I'm this, and they keep on falling off the wagon, and they keep on worshiping these other deities. They keep on
yeah.
mixing with other peoples and worshiping their deities. And so they keep on falling. And so God has to keep on reinforcing, no, you know, you're wrong. He's doing it, I think, gently, but maybe the Israelite people didn't see that as very gentle. But he's trying to move them along and trying to impress upon them that God is a transcendent God.
Let me ask you this, Bob, before you get into continuing the history. A lot of people right now might be saying, a lot of perhaps people on the fence might be saying, why would God want to do that? Why not keep them where they are? They seem to be happy.
Because they were an error in the immanence of God.
They were error about the nature of God.
Right.
Right?
They were an error, and this is God's way of trying to point out that, no, I'm not like anything in creation. I'm different from creation.
What is the advantage of knowing that versus remaining in ignorance in polytheism?
Well, I tell you the truth, I don't know the real reason why, but I can give you an answer. I think the polytheistic gods are really not rational. They're not really believable. Those gods are limited to some sort of extent. And then you would ask, you know, who is, you know, higher than this? And you keep on going up kind of a ladder and saying, well, okay, there's got to be a God beyond that. You
and,
know?
Of course, God is offering us salvation and ultimate happiness. So it makes sense that mankind would turn to him rather than continue in this polytheism that he was in for the longest time.
It seems like these polytheistic gods were creatures themselves.
Yes, that's important. We're going to get to that right after this break, about how the gods of polytheism throughout the world seem to be creaturely. We'll tell you what we mean by that and how that differs from the Judeo-Christian God. You're listening to Beneath the Surface. Paul Morano here with my guest this week, Mr. Bob LeBlanc. Going to take a quick break. Be back right after this. We're back on my guest, Bob LeBlanc's birthday. Bob, how old are you?
Oh, I'm very old.
You're all kinds of old?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. 978-454.
If they could see through the microphone, they would see all this gray hair in my beard.
It's related. Well, it's salt and pepper in the beard. Yeah, salt and pepper.
It's kind
of
funny.
Got a good amount
of
pepper.
If I take off my hat,
yeah,
you would see black hair. Very few gray hairs there. You know, it's like...
I wouldn't go that far.
Oh, okay.
All right. But anyway, happy birthday. Age is relative, right? An 85-year-old would say you're a young sprig. A 25-year-old might say you're an old man.
That's true.
All relative.
It's true. Yeah. I'm not as old as some of the patriarchs of Israel are. You know, what was Abraham, like 180 years old or something like that?
I think he was in his 90s when he had his first child.
Yes, he was. Okay. When he had Isaac, when Isaac was conceived, yes.
Yeah, so it's, keep doing the vitamins and the special diet and you'll live to 120.
Oh, that would be horrible.
978-454-4980 is our BTS hotline here in Beneath the Surface, talking tonight about the transcendence and the immanence of God. The fact that he is so far away and so close simultaneously.
Yeah, that is kind of contradictory, a paradox.
It's a paradox, but isn't God everywhere, omnipresent, as
well? I want to talk about that more. I don't want to go off on that right now. I want to talk about that, though.
All right, so what would you like to go off on now?
Well, we were talking about the creatureliness
of
those polytheistic gods.
And I promised before the break that we'd talk about it again. So, yeah, so the creatureliness of the gods of the pagans were finite in their nature.
Yeah.
They were human-like, but like we said before, like superhuman-like. They were immortal, and yet they were finite. They had vices. They had shortcomings. They would fight with each other. They had some of the negative things of humans.
Well, there's something I know about the Greco-Roman gods.
Okay.
The Romans really just took gods from other places, but the Greek gods, I know the story about them, that, you know... Zeus or Jupiter, he was not the first. He was the father of the gods,
right,
in this kind of a certain way, but he was not the first god. There was a set of gods even before him.
Interesting.
And so the Greek gods that the Greeks came to worship in the later days were overthrown by these gods. And so what happened was is they had, like, one set of gods was replaced by another set of gods, you know, so there was kind of generations of gods that were happening. So you have that creatureliness happening right there.
Well, I tell you what, one thing that you see in the book of Genesis chapter 1, verse 1, is something that overthrows the entire foundation of there being more than one God. And that is that God created everything out of nothing.
Right.
These folks who have, the pagans who believed in many gods, never even considered the possibility of creation not being eternal, the universe not always being here.
They were puny gods that were just making things out of other things.
Yeah, they rearranged things, but they didn't create anything out of nothing.
Right.
Yeah. All right. So where do you want to go from here with this?
Well, okay. Then God, after convincing the Jewish people about His transcendence and oneness and everything like that, then He throws a curveball at the Jewish people. And what happens is that he goes to this little woman in what's modern-day Palestine.
Okay. She must have been, about 14, 15?
Probably 14, yeah, something like that. She was betrothed to a man.
A man named Joseph.
A man named Joseph. Her name was Mary.
Yeah,
and
the house of David.
God sent an angel, Gabriel, to announce to her, hey, you're going to bear the Son of God, which is a surprising thing right there. Because the Jewish people were convinced, no, God doesn't have any sons or anything like that. I mean, God is one.
Right.
He's not like these, because the gods, the polytheistic gods, they would have sons, they would interact with human women, and they would, human women would conceive, and they would bear another god kind of thing, and the Jewish people are going, no, this doesn't happen. We have a God who is, you know, very transcendent. He's beyond us. He doesn't do this sort of thing.
Right.
So God is kind of, okay, I've taught them about my transcendence. Now I'm going to teach them about my immanence. And of course, in Matthew, the first chapter, he talks about Isaiah, the prophet Isaiah, talking about Emmanuel, which means God with us, or God is with us.
Yes.
So here, God is speaking about His immanence here. Mm. It's in the Old Testament, but it's not really forcefully pronounced. But here with the incarnation, where the Son of God takes on a human body, He's entering into His own creation and coming close to us.
It's interesting how at the beginning of the Old Testament, the Israelites kind of anthropomorphized God a bit.
Yes,
right?
They did. Absolutely.
God would get angry. God would have emotions like humans. But one could, a theologian anyway, reading this, could say that this is their perception of the unchangeable God.
Right.
He didn't. He was actually much bigger than what they could digest at the time.
Mm-hmm.
But then the other danger was that God is so other, so different than us, so different than His own creation, which of course He is, that He would never even want to think about having any kind of relationship with it or with us.
So you had,
and this is the danger of the deist God, isn't it?
Yes, exactly. I was going to say exactly that. You know, why would God even care about what's going on this small puny planet and some small sector of the Milky Way, which is only a small little galaxy in amongst all these other galaxies? Why should God care about these things? And I've heard agnostics and atheists kind of bring that up. They say, why should God even care about this sort of stuff?
Well, if they're atheists, that doesn't make any sense to even ask that question.
No, but that's the reason that they're going, well, why should we believe in this Christian God?
Okay.
You know,
all right.
You know.
Yeah, so the deist understanding is that there is a God, but he's more like an impersonal creator force who simply thinks but doesn't care about his creation.
Well, there's even more than that in the deist conception. You know, there's this idea that his creation is completely independent of him.
Yes, yes.
So God is a being, but you have all these creaturely beings that are separate from God.
And the want to say a little bit about the clock kind of theology that some deists have.
Right. So the God is a watchmaker, you know, basically he winds up the world and then he sends it along its way.
Yeah. He creates it, he winds it up, then the world does its thing and God turns its back on his own creation.
Right. He doesn't even care about what's going on anymore.
So this is the deist God, which again is the extreme of being transcendent only.
Right.
Then you have, in another sort of another extreme, you have all of those people, particularly in the eastern part of the world, who believed in a pantheist God.
Right.
That's the other extreme, that God is his creation.
Right, right. Well, or creation is a part of God.
Yeah, it's him. And it wouldn't even be called creation because what we would call creation, they would say it was here for all eternity.
Right.
And if you point to anything in creation, and if I point even to you because you're part of creation, I'd have to say that you are God.
Right, right.
As well as that post, as well as the mountain, as well as all things that
are. So everything is divinity.
Yeah, everything is divinity, everything is God. So both of these extremes about the idea of God were around at the time of Christianity.
Yes.
Aristotle himself, who didn't have any divine revelation of the Jewish people or anyone else, came up with this notion of the deist God, but he couldn't go any further because he didn't know, God didn't reveal himself to the Greeks at that time.
You brought up Aristotle, and you know what I think? I think you can reason from Aristotle and come with an immanent God.
Okay.
And I'll just relate when I was going through college and I was reading Aristotle and his metaphysics, and the idea came to me as I was reading him that Aristotle's a Catholic. And the reason why I say that, this is something that kind of blew my mind, and the more that I studied about God in natural theology, the more I became convinced of this. And if you really, what Aristotle described, and I don't know, maybe we should go into this a little bit, he described God as pure act. And if you understand the implications of that, God cannot be anything but be immanent. If you explore, because what pure act is actually saying is that God has no limitations.
Okay, let's time out right there, and let's unpack that a little bit. First, let me just uncover the irony of what you said, that you think that Aristotle is a Catholic because, of course, he lived 4 centuries before Christ.
Yes.
Okay, so he was very Catholic-like.
He was very Catholic-like,
okay.
Yeah.
I would say the same thing about Socrates, by the way.
Okay.
So if God is pure act, that means, for the non-philosophers out there, that means that God has no potentiality whatsoever. All created beings, including you, me, and the oak tree, have potentiality within us. We are not fully actualized, right?
Right, right. Okay. And so when we're talking about...
We're part actuality, part potentiality.
Right, right. And that is this description of God as being pure act is what I said before. It means that God has no limits.
Right.
So if you look at that, the first thing you'll probably see is you'll see that God is transcendent from this idea of pure act. God is definitely beyond us in conception. I mean, I recognize the frailty of human words and concepts, but Aristotle's idea of pure act really comes close to a target here, I think.
I tell you what, let me couple that with something that God actually said.
Okay. Oh, yes. I know where you're going to go with this.
Yes, and I'll say it. In Exodus chapter 3, 14 is the only place in the entire scriptures that the God says his own name.
Right.
Moses asks, who do I tell them sent me? God says, tell them I am sent you.
Right.
Now, if you look at that term, because these, you know, back in the ancient times, names meant or sort of defined the person. When God says, I am, to the question, you know, what is your name? There is nothing after the word am. Notice that?
Right. Every I am not this. I am not that.
Yeah. Every creature has to have at least some adjectives or some words after the word am. Like you. I am French Canadian, which means I am not Spanish.
Right.
I am tall, which means I am not short. I am black-haired, which means I'm not.
I am a human being, which means I'm not a dog.
You're not a non-human.
Right.
You're Bob, which means that you're not Paul.
Right.
So we have definition because we have boundaries to our being. We're not all things. We're not boundaryless. We are particular human creatures. Yes?
Yes.
Now, in God saying that his name is I Am, if you look at that, it means that there is no boundary.
Right.
With God. There is no limits in God. He simply is. It's not that he was or that he will be. God lives in the eternal and infinite here and now.
Right.
And the word I, by the way, speaks of his immanence. He is a personal God.
He is. That's true.
He's
that's,
not just infinite true. And eternal being with a capital B, limitless being, but he's also personal.
Well, there's also this. I mean, if you talk about pure act, you get this. Limitless, but you can also look at it this way. The immanence comes through the way you said, but I think in prior act, it comes through in this way. There's really nothing that has being apart from God. And in fact, the way St. Thomas Aquinas has a way of explaining God's nature is existence.
Yes. His essence or his nature is existence. And all things that are participate in being.
Right.
God is being. We simply participate in it.
Right. So God is within all.
Yes.
I mean, God is everywhere. There is no place where God is not.
Yes. So God is everywhere within time, space, and matter, but he's also eternally and infinitely transcending that.
Right.
He created it.
Right. And also, which I personally have problems with, is going up maybe a little bit too far on his immanence, you know, where I want to say that there's really, almost in a way, I don't want to go there. I don't want to say that there's nothing apart from God, but it is true. I know from Christianity, from the Genesis, that God is different from creation. He is separate from that.
Oh yeah, of course.
But in the same sort of sense, God seems to permeate all through creation. His existence is every inch.
And if God metaphorically turned his back on creation, it would cease to exist immediately.
Immediately, yes. Yeah.
So he sustains it. He keeps it in existence.
And that's the immediate answer of why is there something rather than nothing?
Right.
That's God. Our definition of God, that's what it means.
Yeah, God not only creates everything out of nothing, but he sustains it continuously.
Right.
And that is a you could say, an infinite power of his. So then God is also, you know, we talked about his transcendence, but we don't want to poo-poo the notion that God seeks and wants a personal relationship with every single human being.
Right. Well, this is where you get Christianity kind of shines on this.
Okay.
I mean, we get an understanding that God loves us. And you could probably find that sense also in the Jewish faith, but it really shines in Christianity.
Yeah, that God is love, because that's his very eternal, infinite nature, and that he has love and cares for his creation, very much unlike the deist God.
Right.
And what is the part of his creation, according to scripture and tradition, that God cares about and loves the most? It's that one species that he made in his image and likeness. Ooh. And we'll talk about who they are right after this break. You are listening to Beneath the Surface here at WCAP Radio. Paul Morano with my guest, Mr. Bob LeBlanc. Be back right after this. Back, 978-454-4980. Beneath the Surface here at WCAP Radio, delving beneath the surface on the topic of the transcendence and immanence of God tonight. Mr. Bob, welcome to segment number three.
Woohoo!
You are very imminently here with me.
I am here.
But you do not transcend the studio at the moment.
I don't.
No.
But you were saying I was transcending, I think, earlier. Saying that I was just a voice
yes.
speaking into the microphone.
You silly goose. Who believed that? 978-454-4980. We're here until 11 o'clock, so let's get to it. Before the break, we were talking about how, well, we sort of were summarizing the notion that God has all of what deism gives him in the sense of being transcendent and being totally other from his universe, and he has some of the good things that pantheism speaks about God in as much as God permeates his universe. But even more than both deism and pantheism, the Jewish and Christian understanding of God is that he is a God of love, of truth, justice, and love, which means that he cares about his creation. And as we were saying before the break, he loves particularly the part of his creation that he made in his image and likeness. And the cliffhanger was, what species is that? Bob, do you have an answer?
I think we can find the answer right there in the first book of the Bible, Genesis.
Oh, we can't find it in a mirror?
Well, you know, let's keep the suspense going.
Oh, okay.
Here,
all right.
Because
all right.
I want to go into that.
All right, go for it.
So we see that God created man, by which we mean humankind.
Okay.
God created man in his image, and it continues on, actually, after that. Male and female, he created them.
Yeah.
Now, that's important because that actually gives us another hint about who God is, because another way of discovering who God is through his creation.
Particularly through his image.
Particularly through his image, yes.
Good point.
And so here we're going to go into political incorrectness.
Let's
here.
Let's do it. I love it.
Talk about maleness and femaleness.
Yes. Masculinity and femininity and how it can be found infinitely in God.
Right, right. And so, now, we're not saying that God has a sex.
Of course not.
God transcends those categories, but somehow, male and female is an icon of God.
Okay, so there's something about maleness and femaleness that can be found, at least allegorically or metaphorically, in the eternal essence of God.
Right.
Okay, so elaborate on that.
So, well,
unless you want me to, but
well,
I'll let you do it
you
first.
You may do better. I think you'll probably expound on what I
okay.
say. So the male aspect the male side of humanity represents the transcendent part of God, and the female expresses the immanent aspect of God. And do you want to take it from here, Paul?
Well, I think that's a good start, that masculinity and femininity is not something that is other than God, because his creation reflects himself. And so in his image, you can find masculinity and femininity as principles throughout all of creation.
Right.
But in human beings, they traditionally are seen in males and females, at least in their relationship to each other. And so what do males and females do? They come together in union, as Genesis tells us, and as, of course, experience tells us. They unite together as one.
Yes.
Right?
Because it goes on further,
yeah.
And Jesus explains it. He explains that men and women, they come to, they go and they leave their parents.
Yeah.
And man finds a wife, and they become one flesh themselves.
Yeah, so what happens when the two become one flesh? Well, there's an image of God here, first, as lover, beloved, and love, right? The lover and beloved become one flesh, and sometimes you have to, as Scott and Kimberly Hahn once said, sometimes you have to name that love 9 months later.
Yes,
in the conception,
absolutely.
In the conception of a child. But even when there isn't a conception of a child, you still have lover, beloved, and love being one as an icon of the Trinity, reflecting God the Trinity. Let's get a little closer into the masculine and feminine part of this, because God loves his creation in the sense that a man loves a woman.
Yes, and that imagery is throughout the Bible, Old Testament
yes.
and New Testament.
The church is the bride of Christ. The people of Israel are God is the groom. They are the bride. Whenever the people of Israel sin against God, it's like adultery. You see that throughout the Old Testament. That union between God and his creation, and particularly God and his people, is like a union between a man and a woman, inasmuch as how God... Well, let me start with number one. What was Eve created out of?
She was created out of man.
Out of Adam.
Out of his rib, yes.
So what was creation created out of?
It was created out of nothing, or you could say it was created out of God.
Out of the mind or heart of God, right?
Right.
So we see a similarity here that Eve is created out of the heart of Adam, the side of Adam, represented in his...
This is very cool.
...in his rib. So you have here the masculine and feminine playing out with God and his creation. So then what did Adam do? He became one flesh. The outside of Adam united with Eve, and just like the external God unites with his creation, impregnates his creation with his divine life... And what do you see in the six-day creation story? Life beginning to sprout, right?
Right.
Because the masculine principle, God, impregnates the feminine principle, creation, with life.
Right.
And particularly, the divine life he gives his image and likeness, mankind.
Right, right.
And so that love relationship is one of a masculine and feminine uniting as one.
Right, and this actually just as kind of a sidebar is why it's very fitting that we have a male priesthood, a male only priesthood, because what the priest does is represents that transcendence, that outsideness. You have God the Father. You see this typical relationship of God the Father interacting with Earth, our mother, or Mother Nature, or
right.
something of that. And so the
yep.
immanence is Mother Nature, so that's the female kind of side of things.
The feminine, yeah.
The feminine. And you know, God is the masculine. What we've been describing previously as biblical language, we see also outside of Scripture... This sort of sense that a pair of masculine and feminine and
right now in the new covenant you have Christ, who is of course the incarnation of God, being the groom and his church being the bride.
Right.
So when it comes to priesthood, as you were saying, you can't have a bride uniting with a bride.
Right.
It does not produce any fruit.
Exactly.
It is a lifeless relationship. Any homosexual relationship, by its very nature, is lifeless. And objectively, anyway, its behavior is loveless, too.
Right, right. And a lot of people are very confused on that point when we say that. We're not saying that two people can't love each other.
Right.
We're
talking as friends, yeah.
As friends, they certainly can. But as a matter of eros, or as
right.
a matter of creation... or procreating, they're not. They're not fruitful in that aspect.
Well, you can't pervert the procreative faculty and call it love.
Right.
You can't. Now, one can have tenderness for another, like you were saying.
Right.
But we're talking about the behaviors. But anyway, with regard to the priesthood, the priest is another Christ with regard to the sacraments, isn't he?
Right, right. So we have a fancy term, a fancy Latin term, in persona Christi.
Right.
Which means that Christ is present in his sacraments. And so when you go to confession... The very life of Christ. When you go to the sacrament of confession or reconciliation, the priest will say, you know, in the name of the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit, I absolve you. He's acting... In the person of Christ, or rather, Christ is acting through his instrument, the priest.
And what is he doing? He is giving the life of Christ to his bride, just like a human husband gives his very life to his bride in the marital act, which sometimes, again, results in a conception.
And the same thing happens during Mass.
Yes.
When the priest says, you know, he raises up the bread, he goes and he says, this is my body.
Right.
You know, he's doing the same thing that he's doing in confession.
And in a sense, what does a groom do on his wedding night? He says, basically, without saying it, the same thing. This is my body that I am giving to you.
Ah.
And what happens with Holy Communion? There is a Eucharistic intercourse. Is there not?
Right, right. Well, between, God is coming into us.
Right. Between the groom, Christ, and the bride, the members of the church, where he is literally giving his life to us in Eucharistic intercourse that we may be filled with his divine life. So there is that masculine-feminine interplay between Christ and his church, between God and his people, between God and his creation, and hence all of this comes together.
Right. You know what? I'd like to do a little bit of a diversion here.
Okay.
There's something that the Greeks figured out. There was a hierarchy of being.
Okay.
And so we can go and look at the very basic sort of thing is the non-living things like stars, rocks.
Yeah.
You know, that's your basic thing of being.
And okay.
Then you go to this next level where you have being that has life.
Yeah.
That's the next level up.
Yeah.
And then you have, well, that would be plants. And then you have sentient sort of beings and animals, things that can move around a little bit and interact with their environment in a more active way. And then the next level, you have intelligence. You know, you have this kind of spiritual being. And then so that would be human beings.
Mm.
And even then, there's Christians would add another level. And you would talk about purely spiritual beings, beings that have no matter, but they are purely spiritual, but they are rational beings.
Yep.
And those would be angels. And then right at the very, very, very top, you have being itself.
Yes. Who is God?
Who is God? And what I neglected to mention before, we're talking about this intellectual or spiritual sort of life that we have, the Greeks had two words for life, at least that I know of, that we use. Mm. We talk about bios.
Yep.
And then the other word is zoe.
Zoe or zoa. Zoe. Yeah.
Which talks about the spiritual life,
that
we lost in the Garden of Eden when Adam and Eve sinned, and so
yeah. So let me recapitulate what you just said. There is a hierarchy of being. It begins with, you would say, generally speaking, the mineral kingdom, then the vegetable kingdom, then the animal kingdom. And then the rational kingdom, if you will, of rational animals, which is the human being. Then there's the angelic kingdom, which are rational non-animals. They're pure spirit without bodies. And then there is he who is himself, God.
Right. And notice that when we talk about the spiritual beings, yes. we're talking about persons. Angels
yes.
are persons. God is a trinity of persons, and human beings are persons.
That is, many philosophers, and I would concur, would say that that is a main thing that makes us his image.
Right.
That we're personal.
Yes.
That we have intellect and will, that we can transcend the physiological, that we are spiritual beings.
And so you see this, that God is trying, even further, he's trying to unite with his creation. He's trying to reunite with his own image, mankind.
Yes.
And he's trying to impart that life to them.
And you could say that the entire Bible is centered on this one theme, that God seeks a covenantal union with his people.
Right.
That's how much God loves his creation, particularly us.
And his love is our life.
Yes. It is our life. Woo. This is deep stuff, and we got to go.
Yes, we do.
All right, we'll ponder this until next time.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Mr. Bob LeBlanc. Thank you for listening, everybody, Beneath the Surface. I'm glad you could join us. Until next time, have a great week, and don't do anything Bob wouldn't do.
All righty.
All right.
Breadbox Media Programming is brought to you by Jack Kane Ford. Find your next Ford Tough vehicle at caneford.com. Woodhill Community Center. Have a hand in the heart of the city. Support their mission with your donations at woodhillcommunitycenter.org. Toyota in Nicholasville Superstore. Online consultants are standing by right now to help you find your next Toyota. Visit Toyota on nicholasville.com. Lexus of Lexington, home of the best-selling Lexus IS. Find yours today at lexusoflexington.com.